Good morning. Ready, Mac? Good morning. We'd like to welcome you to the series, which is called Escape, as we deal with addictive behaviors. Good feelings come from when we do what is right. It's plenty exciting just to do what's right as a Christian. You want adrenaline, you want dopamine, just live right and you'll be blessed. We can be happy. But seeking good feelings, assurance, meaning outside our relationship with God is fundamentally misguided. Worse, when we engage in the kinds of behaviors we'll examine in this series, our brains are affected. They can actually be rewired. The neural networking changes. Not necessarily forever and ever. However, that's a serious thing. And we need to be informed in a number of different areas. Today, we'll focus on marijuana, pain medication, and alcohol. Next week, we'll explore the dangers of alternate fictional realities. We'll lose ourselves in novels or worlds of gaming, TV, series binging, and so forth. Fantasy proxy relationships will be 2 weeks from today in the morning class, particularly internet pornography. And then that afternoon, right after church, our final offering of the series, computer and internet behaviors. Peter, the apostle, says in his second letter that it's possible through God's power to escape the world and its corruption. So first, Steve will talk to us about the psychology and the neurochemistry of pain, escape, and addiction, and then talk about alcohol. So I welcome my fellow teacher during this series, Steve Brand.
Come on, Steve. All right, brother.
All right, thank you. One way to look at addiction is that it's a hijacking of the brain. And so the mind of the addict is not like everybody else. And if we all were to drink, because my topic is alcohol, if everybody were to have a drink, about 10% of us would have trouble stopping. So the problem with stopping is the serotonin in our brain is the braking mechanism that says, I've had enough. And there are about 10% of people that don't have that happening like they should. And so the brakes don't go on. And so there are other people who can drink and say, one and done, okay? And they don't have that thing that makes them keep going and going and going. Now, in our family of churches, we have people that do and don't drink. And there's a scripture I'd like to read that I think applies. 1 Corinthians 6:12 says, I have the right to do anything, you say, but not everything is beneficial. I have the right to do anything, but I will not be mastered by anything. Of course, someone who is an addict has been mastered. And their brain has changed, and they've become addicted, and their mechanism that says, I've had enough, isn't working. And so someone who's addicted might go through 3 days of acute withdrawal, 3 months where they're highly subjected to relapse, and it might take about 3 years for them to start to have natural pleasure without alcohol. And so the problem with addiction and alcohol addiction is that the memory of addiction never goes away. And I'd like to illustrate that on the board. I know we're audio recording this, but I do want to show one way that this happens. Let's say somebody has a thought, I'm lonely, and I'm drawing a line for the audio people down here. I'm drawing a line right here, and then Let's say another person has a thought, I'm sad. Same person. And the line goes down here. And then this line gets a little bit thicker. So what happens with addiction is every time somebody has a need, like I'm bored, and there are some synapses firing, but this line keeps getting bigger. And you think of it like an electric pulse going through the brain. There might be a thought over here that says, I'm going to quit someday. Okay? And maybe there's a little activity there. Okay? But every time this person thinks, I want to look cool, I'm going to have a drink, it goes down here and this line gets thicker. So the electric charge down here to drink gets stronger and stronger. Then say somebody says, I want a girl. And I think if I go out to the club, that's going to help me if I drink a little bit. And this gets stronger here. And maybe there's a thought over here that someday I'm going to quit. So you can see how someone becomes addicted because this becomes an incredibly strong thing. And it goes from a thought to a pattern to a subconscious thing where there's not even a thought. It just becomes automatic. And so over and over and over again, the person makes this decision, even though this is always in the back of their mind, someday I'm going to quit. One of my favorite metaphors that I've ever heard is about the eagle and the rabbit. There's an eagle flying around in the North Country, let's say Alaska, you know, looking for something to eat in the winter. And nothing. Days, the eagle is starving. And then one day, there's a movement on a piece of ice floating in a river. And the eagle says, rabbit, you know? And he flies down, and he sinks his talons into that rabbit and kills it. And he hears something in the distance, a waterfall. And he just is on that iceberg with his blood flowing through his body and eating that rabbit and having a good time. And when he decides it's time to fly away because the waterfall is right there and he's had his fill of rabbit, he flaps his wings to fly, but his talons are frozen in the ice and he goes over the edge. That's kind of the way addiction works, is you think, I can handle it. It's okay, I'm hungry. There's a rabbit, you know, just one. But you fly down, you land on that thing, and you start eating it, and a day becomes a week becomes a month, and a month becomes years, and can become decades. And I have personal experience. I spent about 3.5 years of my life drinking every day, and drinking not for the taste, but drinking for one reason. I was a binge drinker in high school and college. I drank to get drunk. And I have a family riddled with addiction. And so if you have a family history with addiction in it, that's something to even be more concerned about. A few other things about alcohol I wanted to share. About 100,000 deaths a year are alcohol related. 16,000 are fatalities involving car crashes. Of course, Galatians 5 says drunkenness is a sin. About 40% of college students binge drink. Alcohol can go from abstinence to use to abuse to addiction. The phrase that they use in the government is alcohol abuse syndrome. That's alcoholism. Side effects, cravings, this is for alcoholism. Cravings, hiding drinking, minimizing, tolerance buildup, withdrawal from people, isolation from people, personality changes, loss of control, physical changes, including cirrhosis of the liver, nutritional imbalance, vitamin B2 deficiency, which leads to Korsakoff syndrome, and drinking becomes the central activity of one's life. So what happens when somebody becomes an alcoholic or any addiction, bringing it back to all addictions, is the reward system is messed up in the brain. Now, for our purposes as disciples, we might want to spend time with our wife or our husband or our kids, and we have that as a value. But when you're an addict, it doesn't matter. The number one thing you're seeking is your addiction. And so what you value, what you want, is you want, in terms of alcohol, you want a drink, and another, and another, and another. And so what they've discovered is that people that become alcoholics, that 10% of people, they have problems with impulsivity, they have problems with their dopamine levels being low, and their serotonin levels, the braking system, isn't happening there. And so they never get satisfied. And it's kind of like the proverb that talks about the leech. You know, the leech has two daughters. Give, give, they cry. And addiction, alcoholism, is like a leech. It just sucks the life out of people. I'm going to let Douglas come up and speak, and we'll take a few questions later. But I've got more, but we'll take a break.
Well, I think we can tell already that this is not a class on alcoholism only, nor will I be speaking exclusively on pot, because neither on it nor about it, okay? Because the principles are the same. There are all kinds of behaviors, and we're remarkably creative at finding things to be addicted to, especially if we're compensating for something in our lives or we're impulsive. I've never actually smoked pot. I was visiting my first university, the first time I was still in high school, there was a group of cool people standing around, passing around a marijuana cigarette. By the time it got to me, it was so covered with saliva that all I could do was just pretend. I couldn't even bring myself to put it on my lips because I was grossed out. But you know, you can't decide things by whether you're grossed out or not. That is, you say, well, that doesn't bother me, therefore I do it, or that sickens me, or I don't like that, so I won't do it. Now, that's not the way we decide things biblically. We don't just go by feelings. And this is such an old discussion, the thing about marijuana. I remember in fifth grade, and for me, that was in 1970, in school, this was the discussion. I mean, the teachers orchestrated it. It was part of the curriculum. I'm sure it has been ever since. Should it be legalized? And right now, this year, 2014, it's being legalized more and more places in the world, and it's pretty clear it will be legalized everywhere soon. Are you one of those few brothers or sisters saying, well, once it's legal, nothing's holding me back from doing it? The government legalized adultery. You used to get in trouble for that, not anymore. It's actually permissible. The government has legalized homosexuality, pornography, gay marriage, and soon recreational marijuana everywhere. But I would ask, who gives us permission for our behaviors? Is it the government or is the Lord? As Steve read, not everything is beneficial, even if it is permissible. Human legislation doesn't make sin okay in God's eyes, and human laws seldom, seldom call us to God's standard of God's holy word. Laws regulate divorce, prostitution, pornography, and so forth, but they don't call us to live a holy life. Sanjay Gupta may say, pot's okay, it doesn't hurt you, governments may approve it, but I think the reasons we should hesitate to jump on the bandwagon. For one, we are talking about intoxication. Now, it's true, there's that ingredient, is it tetrahydrocannabinol? If the level's a little bit lower, as in some medical marijuana, maybe there's no intoxication. But come on, people who smoke, they're doing it, 99% of them, for one reason, just like the drinking. And Ephesians 5:18 says, don't get drunk on wine. Did Paul need to add, don't get intoxicated on anything else? Because if you're under the influence of marijuana, you're legally intoxicated. If you get pulled over, you're in trouble. We shouldn't jump on the bandwagon because there's big money in this, and we should smell a rat. Because of the negative effects, I've got an article at my website, marijuana slows reaction time, gives a difficulty concentrating, affects our depth perception, short-term memory, altered sense of time and space. And so we may be actually asking the wrong questions about this. It's not, is it legal, but is it Christ-like? Not, well, can I pursue happiness in my own way, but why am I not pursuing holiness? Not what can I do, what's okay for me to do, but what would Jesus actually do? And if you can see Jesus smoking on a drag, I wonder, is it the same Jesus? Maybe we need to rethink that. And then let me say something about pain medication. People become addicted to pain medication. Did you ever see an episode of House? He's a doctor who is in great pain, and sometimes he steals pain medication from his own patients. You know, like they're unconscious. He says, do you need that? No, I didn't think so. And he just takes it from them. It's amazing how we can rationalize the use of pain meds. Now, I know something about this because I have very severe back pain, and I take some medication every day. And without that, I become pretty miserable and grumpy. But once, maybe 5 years ago, I was in pain, and I found some pain meds. They weren't mine. They weren't given to me. It was inside something else that was given to me. I thought, whoa, this looks serious. I looked it up online. I thought, oh, that's a painkiller. I wonder what that's like. Well, it can't be that different to, you know, at that point, I guess the Advil I was having, although it certainly was. It raised my body temperature almost immediately. And I just had the one, and I tried another one, and another one. And I think I finished all six. And that didn't lead anywhere else, but I didn't tell anyone. In fact, I haven't told anyone until just now, today. But that's good, because I saved face. People didn't disrespect me, and besides, I'm very strong, and I can resist addictive behaviors, because there's not a compulsive bone in my body. What I'm saying, in a somewhat indirect way, is that none of us is above getting sucked in. Whether it's pain medication, marijuana, or alcohol, we need to really be on our watch. Would you add anything about the pain medication or the marijuana?
I would just say I've known three really, really strong brothers. Like if I told you their names, you would be surprised, you would be shocked, who have had pain in various parts of their body, been prescribed pain medication, and gotten addicted. So it's not something that's just like OxyContin, hillbilly heroin getting bought on the street. It's something that people that you would really be shocked and surprised to hear are struggling with. And it's, as we all age and we get more aches and pains, and more aches and pains that are legitimately prescribable according to a medical doctor, medical doctors often, most of the times, they almost never ask, do you have a history of addiction? And so you may be an addict and you may be clean for 30 or 40 years, and a doctor might just write you a script and you might be secretly loving it. But then you might end up like the eagle and the rabbit going over the cliff. Well, we don't want that.
They don't normally ask, do you have some unconfessed sin?
Yeah, right.
You've been holding back on your personal holiness. But all of these things feed into the loop.
Yeah. That's it for now.
Well, we think you may have some questions. You know, I noticed the beginning of this is a novel in Britain. It's so common. This is the first paragraph. When he first sees her, Raph is sitting on a washing machine about to swallow an eighth of a gram of what is apparently a mixture of speed, monosodium glutamate, and an experimental social anxiety drug for dogs. And people will try anything for a buzz. And since it's increasingly legal, and the conviction about this stuff, at least in most of the churches where I speak, isn't really that high, we're in danger of becoming high. Okay. So we would love to talk with you a little bit. We will conclude at not 9:40, that's 15 minutes. But do you have some questions or concerns? Our job is not to present all information, but to make you think. And we want you to think biblically about this. Think theologically. Think, what does God say? Not, you know, what's acceptable. What does the neighbor say?
I have one comment about alcoholism. I think the thing that concerns me about the new push for marijuana is that with alcohol, somebody, the biblical way to think about alcohol is that it should be a beverage. So if you're even thinking about how much to drink, probably a sign.
Hang on, wait. This is just for the recording. So biblically, alcohol is a beverage. He was led astray by beer. Wine is not wise. But once you start asking, well, how many units can I have? How close can I get? What's the, you know, what's my tolerance and so forth? We should be, alarm bells should go off. That's an important comment. Does that apply to marijuana cigarettes? You know, like after two, I'm really not myself anymore, which is a good thing.
There's some evidence I wanted to share and then take some more questions. Those of us who drank heavily before the age of 25, you know that we tell our teenagers all the time that their brain isn't fully developed till they're 25, you know, so we give them cars, but, you know, a lot of us before we became Christians drank heavily, and we damaged our brain. And so that explains what's wrong with some of you and what's wrong with me, okay? But you actually damaged your brain, and there's evidence now. The weed that's out today is 10 times stronger than what I smoked when I was in high school and college. And there's evidence today that it really does hurt your brain. And so it's not a harmless thing that medical marijuana is okay. The other stuff is so strong that it really does something. Also, ecstasy. A lot of people take ecstasy to go out to the clubs and dance and, you know, go to raves and that kind of thing. And ecstasy damages the brain. So there are a lot of these things that seem like just harmless fun, and some of us have already done some damage that we didn't even know we did.
But what if there is no harm? We have to be careful. Yeah. We don't shift the discussion. Well, if it does no harm, then it's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, does drinking a glass of wine harm you? Well, it could. I guess you could drown in a glass of wine if you're asleep in just the right way. But it's not about harm, because you'd say, okay, I'm waiting for the research study that shows it's not really hurting me, or I get the right brand, the menthol marijuana, you know, and with the big filter. It's not about that. Remember, we're talking about Christ. We're talking about being holy. We're getting our sense of identity, meaning, the positive feelings from our relationship with God, not from substances. There's a question. Great.
Maybe a few years before and after, but 25 to 35, a lot of the singles and things. As disciples, there are so many things that separate us from the world, so many things that we have to say no to that we cannot do. And so being younger and being, you know, insecure, we want to fit in. And alcohol is one of these things that it's not wrong biblically, and therefore it's something that we can do to kind of feel like normal, right? And feel like we're fitting in, and it's fun, and it's so subjective that some people have issue with it, some don't. But I have noticed myself a trend in the church among the singles, and I can't speak for the campus. Maybe this is the case too, but I know for the singles specifically, that there seems to be an emphasis on the importance of alcohol as a part of social engagements, and I rarely see people overdoing it, but it's always there. And so I think there's a lot of gray area there.
Okay, we need to move on. Do you have a question also?
Yeah.
Certainly a great comment.
Yeah, what I'd like to say in response to that is I think that comes into the area of not just everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial, but the weak and the strong. And if alcohol is a regular thing at every social occasion, there are some people that can't handle that. There are some people that will go over the edge, and it could ruin their life for decades because of that. So we have to be careful.
The recent issue of Christianity Today, the lead story is on being alcohol-free. And the question they ask is, and I'm not saying that you have to, you know, I think we should have alcohol in the communion. I mean, I think we should be like Corinth, you know. The issue is if you always have alcohol, do you have any friends? Do you know anyone who's on the street or in recovery? Because when you know people who struggle with that, you tend to give up your right and drink less. So several of the writers in Christianity Today were making a case for being alcohol-free, not because that makes you more holy, but in order to connect better with people for whom this is a world of pain. And we don't ask that question. We're not trying to be legalistic here.
But we are trying to stimulate some good discussion. So any more questions?
Okay, the comment is, very short, please. The comment is that when we have people over to our homes practicing hospitality, finding out, just as you'd ask if there's a food allergy, does something make you gag? No, but do you have a, are there any issues, the alcohol with you or with any of the people who are coming over? Because for many people, there are. And I would hate to think I'm serving wine if I've got a person or two at the table who's later on that night, after they say good night, you know, they're going to be drinking a bottle. That's a very important thing.
Yeah.
Sorry for repeating the question, but they have to be short, please, and we're being recorded. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so I look around the room, and I would think that most people in here are people who are either beginning to be more educated about this and have seen a need for the education, either in their own lives or someone they're close to. But the majority of the congregation isn't in here. So as Bible Talk leaders, as people who are engaged in listening to these things and hearing about the problems, and the education isn't mainstream, it doesn't necessarily come up in our midweeks and on Sunday services, What's our role? What do we do?
Well, I'll say my thing. You need to get them to go to the website. This will be at my website. It will be at the church website, or you can get the CD and just start right there. Listen to the material. Okay, Steve?
Yeah, I think it... Another role we have is to make people think, you know, just to say, hey, have you thought about that passage, 1 Corinthians, about the weak and the strong? And if you're having a social occasion, if you're having a dinner, ask people, you know, is it okay? Do you struggle with this? And you don't want to cause somebody to stumble. I mean, the passage about tying a millstone around your neck and being thrown in the midst of the sea, that's a pretty serious passage. So we don't want to be guilty of that.
Luke 17, verses 1 and 2. And that's Jesus for real.
What about someone who doesn't know? I mean, part of this is just being deceived as to can I handle it, can I not handle it?
What about someone who doesn't know?
Yeah. That they are susceptible to falling into this.
Some people may not know that they're susceptible, so it's something of a moot point, isn't it? I mean, we'll find out. Although... Yeah, I don't know. I think the important thing is that we're even thinking this way and asking the question.
Yeah, and I think back to what I said a little bit earlier, if 1 in 10 people are lacking the brain chemistry to say stop, and that could be stop with food, it could be stop with sexual things, it could be stop with alcohol, drugs, marijuana, pain medication. If 1 in 10 people have that problem, that means 10% of our congregation. 10%, not necessarily people in this room, this is a little bit of a skewed audience, but 10% of people on the street, 10% of your family members, 10% of people you're going to be having over for dinner are going to struggle with addiction. And they're not going to have the brain chemistry to always be able to stop.
So just invite 9 people and you'll be safe.
Yeah.
It's like left-handedness.
9 out of 10.
1 in 10 people, so... Does anyone else want to ask a question who hasn't? This may be the last one just for the time. How about over on the left?
As parents of a teenager, would you suggest that you have an abstinence, you know, as an example, or is it more wise to show them a healthy respect for alcohol?
Should teen parents show a model of abstinence or simply show self-control in the home? How do we engage it? Steve? I was just repeating it for the recording.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I think there are some cultural things here. Like in other parts of the world, children grow up drinking alcohol. Now, the research says that alcohol can cause brain damage before 25, so that's not necessarily a good plan. I think you husband and wife have to decide what's best, and I don't think that can be legislated or dictated, but I think that's a great question. That's a great discussion question. I don't know that there is a right or wrong with that. I think if parents have a huge history of addiction and they decide to drink in the home, and their kids can have some kind of a, you know, roll the dice genetically, and some of those kids might have the genetic predisposition, the weakness in the ability to stop, then that's a huge thing to think about if you're a drinking parent and you have children that might end up addicted.
That's excellent. And you can see how this would broaden out to all kinds of other behaviors, because we may have genetic predispositions to anger, compulsive behavior, sexual orientation. They're genetic components to many things that God calls us to rise above. And we don't want to make laws, but we do need to be guided by principle. And I hope we'll have some really great talks about this in the fellowship.
Yeah. My favorite scripture on that is 1 Peter 1:18. It says that you've been redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your forefathers by the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. So whether we have claimed our redemption or not, it's like if I give you $1 million, when is it yours? Well, you have to take it out of my hand. So that redemption has been there since that scripture was written, since God made it available through the cross. So everybody has been redeemed, but what have we been redeemed from? The empty way of life handed down to you from your ancestors, from your forefathers, from your mother and father, your grandparents, your aunts and uncles. Excellent. And so there's a genetic thing there, but we have to overcome it by claiming our redemption.
There's flesh and there's spirit, and we decide how to live. 1 Peter 1:18, great verse. I was going to close with 1 Peter 2:16. Live as free people, but don't use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as God's slaves. You know, we can say in the name of freedom or maturity, you know, I can indulge in this, I can take that, I can handle that. But that's not the way we're to be. 2 Peter, as Steve referred to in the beginning, talks about how our minds can be affected and we get caught. We're going to be looking next week at alternate fictional realities, movies, novels, worlds of gaming, television, because there are many clusters of addictive behaviors. And if we don't talk about this, then we'll just default, and people in the church will end up not really being that different to people outside. In all of this series, we want to keep in mind this thought, this inspiring and ennobling thought. By his divine power, God has given us everything we need for living a godly life. We received all this by coming to know him, the one who called us to himself by means of his marvelous glory and excellence. And because of this glory and excellence, he has given us his great and precious promises. And these are promises that enable you to share his divine nature and to escape the world's corruption caused by evil desires. And thank you so much for being here. Look forward to see you next week.
Amen. Yeah.